Chapter 22. Profit Zero. Emerging markets are difficult places in which to do business, and South China may be among the most difficult of all. For those who wonder how they would fare at this game, I propose a scenario. Imagine yourself landing at the Guangzhou airport late one night. You get to the curb and find a taxi driver who says he is willing to take you to your hotel for $20. It's a reasonable rate, but then the driver stops the car once you have left the airport. You are in the middle of nowhere, no street lights or other signs of life, and there are almost no other cars on the road. The cabbie informs you that he cannot possibly take you into town for only $20, but for $30 now, he would be more than happy to. If you do not wish to pay the extra $10, he won't hold it against you. He will allow you to get out of the taxi where he has stopped without charging you the fare for driving you from the airport to this darkened roadside void, because he's not a bad person, you see. It's a multiple-choice question. What do you do? A. Pay the additional amount the driver wants and let him take you to the hotel for $30. B. Get out of the car and find another ride. C. Tell the driver that you will agree to his conditions, but when you arrive at the final destination, explain that he acted in an unethical manner and pay him only the original $20. Those who answered A, give the driver the extra money he wants, are true humanitarians, with perhaps a soft spot for bankruptcy lawyers. $10 is not a lot of money in the grand scheme of things, but in percentage terms, it's substantial. An importer who allows a manufacturer to swallow profitability in a last-minute pricing scheme will lose business. Last-minute price increases are a gun to the head, and anyone who gives in easily to such tactics will, sooner or later, find themselves out of business. Now, if you answered B, get out and find another ride, you are in even more trouble. There is no one on the roads at this late hour, and whoever does pass by is not going to stop for a strange figure standing in the dark. In contract manufacturing, it can take a substantial amount of time to get a new relationship started. Getting out of the car with the hope that you will catch another ride is like telling the factory to take a hike, that you'll be taking your business elsewhere, except that there is nowhere else to go. Your manufacturing orders need to be sent to the retailer within 2 or 3 weeks. You don't have the 4 to 6 months that it takes to set up a new supplier relationship. By the time you find a new supplier and get them up to speed, your customers have left you for the competition. In other words, you're out of business. No, you're smarter than that. You're not falling for either A or B, and you probably believe that anyone who behaves in such a poor, unethical manner deserves to have the same thing done to him. Let's play by their rules, you're thinking. When in Rome, and all that. Answers A and B are for China novices, you say. You went with the third option, C, telling the driver that you'll agree to a higher price, but then, when you get to the hotel, you hand him $20 and tell him that that's all he deserves, and that he ought to be ashamed of himself. What you have forgotten is that the taxi driver wants that last $10 a lot more than you do. He also believes that he deserves that extra 50%, if only because he had been so clever in the first place. Proving to him that he is not so smart registers with the driver as a loss of face, and he will hold out until the police are involved for the principal as well as for the money. The polite discussion you have at a police station lasts until 4 a.m. or until you give in. The taxi driver doesn't mind the extra inconvenience, because for him it is not an unforeseen annoyance, but simply a part of the job. Before he ever laid eyes on you, he planned to find a customer, preferably an unsuspecting foreigner, negotiate a price, drive halfway down the road, and then renegotiate. Many deals that initially seemed too good to be true in China, like a low price, often ended in tears and disappointment. In the wake of so many product recalls of China-made goods, many people rushed to the defense of Chinese manufacturers, saying that low prices were to blame and that importers had pressured manufacturers into making products for next to no profit. This claim that manufacturers were pitiable and that they had been forced did not square with my own observations in China. For years I watched as manufacturers willingly entered into deals where profits seemed low, but at the same time these manufacturers grew wealthy. Factory owners cried poor, but then they built fantastic capacity expansions and were personally transformed by sudden wealth. China was in the middle of the greatest economic boom in world history, as anyone knew, and while it might have been argued that some factories were prospering while others were losing their shirts, this did not seem to provide a full explanation for what was happening. Working in China manufacturing, I began to ask questions. Why would a Chinese manufacturer willingly make a product for a dollar and sell it for only a dollar? Chinese manufacturers did not have the same concerns for covering fixed costs as their counterparts in capitalist countries had. Could it be that this was all part of a long-term strategy and that Profit Zero was economically efficient? One day I was standing at the front gate of King Chemical when I saw something unusual. One of the factory's trucks that was about to leave the plant appeared loaded with empty Johnson Carter bottles. Plastic bottles were typically brought into the site from a supplier, but they never left empty. These were bottles for our bubble bath line. It was one of the bottles that the factory actually produced by itself in a small building at the edge of the property, and because the factory also filled them on the premises, it made no sense that the bottles should be going anywhere. Catching the driver on his way out, I asked where he was heading. "To the other factory," he said, "the one by Town Hall." This happened a few months before the episode involving the new shiny factory. At that time, we were aware of no other operation, and Bernie had been concerned. "I need you to find that other factory," he said, "but don't tell anyone you're looking for it." Hiring a car, I drove around the area that the driver had indicated. He had referred to a government building that was not in the city of Shantou, but in a smaller municipality closer to King Chemical. After 2 days of searching, I found the place in a block of buildings along a polluted irrigation canal. It was hardly what you would call a factory, though, just a tiny building with a few workers inside. They were labeling plastic bottles by hand, with Johnson Carter labels. The odd thing about the makeshift operation was that they were preparing bottles for bubble bath, and at that time we didn't have a standing order for the product. "What do you think they're doing there?" Bernie asked, although he already had an idea. He had been working with an agent out of Australia who sold health and beauty care products in the Middle East and throughout Southeast Asia. He had placed a few orders, several containers worth, including, coincidentally, an unusually large volume of the bubble bath. The Aussie sent us a few orders and then vanished. Bernie tied the two events together and figured that the agent had contacted the factory directly and was ordering Johnson Carter product behind its back. Bernie was cut out of the picture, and by trading in bootlegged versions of Johnson Carter merchandise, the agent and the factory both earned slightly more for themselves. Counterfeiting was a huge problem in China, and one of its most pervasive forms involved the manufacturer selling surplus product to unauthorized agents. For Chinese manufacturers that sold product to their primary customer for close to cost, contraband operations of this sort were an important profit center. Sister immediately learned about my visit, of course, and was only awaiting Bernie's response. I asked him whether he wanted me to confront King Chemical about the makeshift labeling operation. Bernie surprised me by saying that he wanted the matter left alone. He didn't want to pursue it. There was no point in upsetting the factory, he said, for the profit that could be earned on just a couple of containers. Johnson Carter was shipping out hundreds of containers. To raise a fuss with the factory on such a small matter would only place Johnson Carter's broader business at risk. American importers who conducted large volumes of business shared this attitude when it came to counterfeiting in China. Just so long as these backdoor operations did not directly interfere with an importer's core business, a small amount of such illicit activity was actually tolerable. Johnson Carter had more business than it could handle in the United States, Bernie explained. He barely had the time to fly to China. Trying to catch and manage accounts in such far-flung markets as Dubai or Manila made no sense. "If it means so much to the factory," he said, "that they have to go and sneak around like that, let them have it." Bernie's idea was to let the factory carry on with whatever sideline business they might have created. The biggest challenge was keeping prices low. If the factory was able to generate additional income through a bit of bootlegging, then the manufacturer could consider the opportunity created as one of the many benefits of working with a company like Johnson Carter. Chinese manufacturers did not only counterfeit big brand products, they were also involved in the counterfeiting of their customers' products, even when those products were not very well known. They copied because it was easy, or, in many cases, because they were not as good at creating their own new concepts. Chinese exporters were good at manufacturing merchandise, but they lacked a marketing instinct, which was paradoxical given their skill at stagecraft and their ability to manage impressions. It was easy to forgive manufacturers their lack of marketing savvy, but it was more difficult to overlook the wide gap that remained in product design. China manufactured so much of what the world purchased, and yet it did not do original design. It was somewhat telling that even at the height of the export boom, China did not have a single school of product design worth mentioning. Finding it difficult to catch design talent, manufacturers continued to rely on their customers to tell them how a product should be made. What manufacturers lacked in originality, they made up for in their ability to copy. They were masters of mimicry, and factory owners would simply insist, "We only need your product sample." No matter whether it was a winter coat, a toaster oven, or a lamp, manufacturers could be counted on not only to reverse engineer the product with great precision, but also to replicate it with great speed. The ability to take an initial sample and duplicate it was the real magic that brought so many importers to China in the first place. International trade was a game that required short lead times. This was especially true in industry sectors where style and seasonal change was involved. Garments, shoes, toys, accessories, home furnishings, even hardware, these were all sectors that were heavily influenced by frequent, often seasonal, changes in design. For companies that originated changes in product design, the goal was to move a product quickly from the drawing board to production. For the large number of importers that operated as copycats, there was a similar rush to get behind these trendsetters and to move faster than their competitors in getting their products to market. Americans somehow imagined that Chinese factories existed to manufacture merchandise only for the United States, but this was not the view from China at all. From China, the world appeared divided into two parts. One half of the world was made up of countries where intellectual property rights enjoyed wide protection. Because patents and trademarks were honored, there was not coincidentally a great deal of investment going on in the area of product design and marketing. Order sizes in this first market, which included the United States and Canada, as well as a number of Western European countries, tended to be larger. Chinese manufacturers favored importers from these economies, not so much because of their volume, but more for what they could lend in the way of design and marketing. Manufacturers gave considerable discounts in order to entice these first market importers to place orders in China. The other half of the world was made up of secondary economies where intellectual property was not very well protected. In this second market, investment in product design was low. China still wished to do business with this other half of the world because, while its volumes were low and it did not provide much in the way of design, it tended to pay higher prices for goods out of China. One of the features that characterized China's export market in the first decade of the 21st century was the way in which it took advantage of being at the very center of the globalization phenomenon. China was at a crossroads of international trade, and importers were arriving not just from places like the United States, but also from Latin America and the Middle East, economies where trademark and copyright were not observed. Manufacturers that produced products using unique, original designs provided by importers realized that they were perfectly positioned to take advantage of the situation by moving designs from one part of the world to the other while earning a premium in the process. This was not customer segmentation, but an arbitrage opportunity. The United States was one of the wealthiest economies in the world, and yet Americans paid less for their products than consumers did elsewhere. It was, in fact, one of the great ironies of the global economy. Products that retailed in the United States for only $1 in a dollar store could be found in the developing world selling for $2 and $3. And it was one reason why tourists from poorer economies took their trips to the United States as shopping sprees. Many of the manufacturers with whom I worked realized about half their revenue from just one or two customers from this first market. These customers were either from the United States or Canada, or they were from large customers from leading economies such as Japan, Germany, or France. The balance of their business was made up of anywhere from 50 to 100 smaller importers from the second market. First market importers might generate no profit at all, and a manufacturer's entire bottom line could instead derive solely from second market customers. An example in counterfeiting illustrates how some manufacturers took advantage of the arbitrage opportunity in an outright sense. A manufacturer accepts an order for 500,000 pieces from a first market importer that produces a unique design. Rather than merely fill the order, the supplier keeps the machines running and its people working until it produces a total of 700,000 pieces. The original customer gets his order for 500,000 pieces, and then the factory sells the surplus of 200,000 pieces at a considerable markup. For manufacturers willing to engage in an illicit practice of this kind, it made sense to agree to produce the original order at close to cost. The margin that could be earned on surplus product in some categories easily exceeded 100 to 200%, and trying to earn a modest 10% profit on the original order might mean losing out to a competitor who would bid lower. Intense competition was a major driving force in China, and any manufacturer that actually attempted to work out a profit margin for itself on an original order might find a competitor pricing the initial order at cost or sometimes below cost. The uniqueness of the product was what mattered most, and it had everything to do with how aggressively factories quoted. Some of the smarter importers I have met, those who actually understood how the game worked in China went out of their way to suggest that their product was unique. In other words, that they had something that might be counterfeited and sold through other channels. In any event, Chinese manufacturers who complained that they were not earning a profit for themselves were not always telling the entire story. Chinese manufacturers had other reasons for being in business, and they operated in a world where economic principles differed. One aspect that made manufacturing different in China was the symbiotic relationship formed between the export manufacturing sector and government. Throughout the 1980s and into the 1990s, when the planned economy failed to create enough jobs to attain full employment, the Communist Party looked to private industry to put people to work. Entrepreneurs who could offer jobs garnered a degree of political clout with government officials. In the 2000s, manufacturers were encouraged with a different political emphasis, bringing in foreign currency. Chinese companies that were not able to earn much of a profit were still able to earn political influence, and it was with these motivations in mind that manufacturers found themselves entering into deals. Johnson Carter might have had something to do with changing King Chemical's political standing. I understood this the day that sister showed me a picture of her husband meeting with Communist Party officials. In China, political connections were more important. Money was ephemeral, but Guanxi was everlasting. Chinese industrialists did not mind manufacturing merchandise for no profit, just so long as doing so created an opportunity in some other way. I was working on a furniture project when the owner of one factory explained that, even though times were tough, he had just built a new factory for $5 million. Before construction on the new facility was complete, he had a new property valuation performed, which came in closer to $10 million. The company owner said he was going to the bank to borrow the difference, and then he planned to take this extra cash and put it into various investments. He was going to invest in residential real estate. Because they felt they had something to gain, King Chemical offered to produce products for Johnson Carter for close to cost, and while the health and beauty care industry was not heavily influenced by fashion, there were still trends, and many new products originated in the first market. Johnson Carter was aware of new changes as they happened because it was working closely with major retail chains. The samples that Johnson Carter sent to King Chemical went right to the factory showroom as examples of the factory's capabilities. New customers were shown these samples and asked if they would like to purchase them or some modified version. Chinese manufacturers did not need to steal the intellectual property of their customers to gain an advantage. Sometimes, all that was needed was access to the general idea of a new product or line. Johnson Carter introduced all kinds of new products, including tea tree oil, body sprays, and body butter. When Johnson Carter asked King Chemical to produce a kind of antibacterial soap, the factory had to ask for details about the process. In business, information is power. Once the factory had the knowledge about how to make a particular product, it could then tell prospective buyers that it had this new capability. Johnson Carter helped push King Chemical to the head of its field by supplying it with trend information and product knowledge. King Chemical was not involved in any real estate schemes. The company was in manufacturing for the opportunity in international trade. But even then, the owners did not think of their business in such a plain linear fashion. Chinese industrialists were characterized by their singular willingness to make major sacrifices for the hope of a benefit in the distant future, and one key strategy for manufacturers involved manufacturing goods for no profit at all. One of the key challenges that new manufacturers faced was that importers preferred to work with suppliers that had experience. In this regard, Chinese manufacturers faced the same paradox as college graduates. Experience was needed to land a job, but without prior job, there was no experience to be had. The factory agreed to produce merchandise at close to cost in order to prove its expertise. For the manufacturer, Johnson Carter's account was the equivalent of an unpaid internship. Once the factory learned how to make a product line that was up to export standards, the factory owners could convince other importers to take a chance with them. King Chemical's showroom was filled with examples of products that the factory had made for Johnson Carter. Along a single wall in the showroom, Johnson Carter's modest product line appeared rather impressive, especially to those importers who came from the second market. These prospective customers did not know that Johnson Carter was a new company. An American company produced the product line and trusted this particular supplier. That was enough. There was another reason to work with an importer for next to no profit, and that was for the opportunity to connect with the importer's customers. Business know-how did not only involve product specifications, it also involved the knowledge of who the players in the industry were. Johnson Carter was working with most of the biggest retailers in the country. This included supermarkets, drugstores, and discount chains, all of which were willing to sell soap and shampoo products made in China. The factory wanted access to these players. At the same time, retailers also got it in their heads that they could disintermediate or remove the importer. When disintermediation took place, it tended to benefit the Chinese company more often. An importer who was purchasing a product at $2.25, for example, might have sold that product to a retailer for $4.40. The retailer then got the idea, I'll go around the importer, straight to his supplier, and I'll pick up the same product for $2.25. However, when the retailer went direct, it was surprised to learn that the manufacturer was not willing to sell at $2.25, but was instead trying to get the same price, $4.40, that the retailer had been paying the importer. In the end, the factory would cut the retailer a small discount to entice the importer's customer to cut the importer out of the picture. Once the supplier and the retailer had burned their bridge, the supplier was then, of course, free to raise prices. Johnson Carter had customers that were looking to go around it to purchase direct, but the importer held a key advantage that its customers did not. It had buying power. In the area of private label soap and shampoo, Johnson Carter bought in larger volumes than any one of its customers. Companies that disintermediated the middleman quite often suffered, if only because they did not have as much volume. Manufacturers naturally welcomed the possibility of customers losing buying power because it gave them the chance to charge more for their products. Manufacturers entered into business relationships where they earned no profit, knowing that they could find a profit opportunity down the road. China's non-performing loan ratio was high, in part because lenders were passing out cheap money in support of this profit zero strategy, and it did work. Manufacturers built large facilities, and when the importers saw these factories, which looked capable and safe, they came rushing into the marketplace. It was a long-term strategy that involved patience and an inevitable reversal of fortune for the manufacturer. While some importers were under the impression that China exported products primarily for the United States, the reality was that America took in only one-fifth of all that China made. While significant, what also had to be taken into account was that because American companies tended to pay less for China-made products, their orders actually accounted for a considerably smaller portion of profit for Chinese exporters. American importers were important to these suppliers, not for the profit that they generated, but more because of the opportunities that they afforded. Walmart's economic significance to China is a case in point. Manufacturing products for the retail giant has rarely been a chance for manufacturers to earn wide margins because the company demands to purchase at the lowest prices possible. But Chinese factory owners liked the idea of being able to say that they were a supplier to Walmart because Walmart's reputation for supplier audits was so strong. Estimates of Walmart's outsourcing volume in China were right around $9 billion at a time when China was exporting more than $1.2 trillion worth of goods. Walmart, in other words, accounted for less than 0.75% of all exports out of China. The retailer's true value to the economy was in providing factories with a reputation that they could later monetize. Walmart was moving from supplier to supplier in China, giving new players a chance to capitalize on its reputation, and yet its purchase volume was reported to be flat over a number of years. Walmart enjoyed the advantage of lowered prices at each new supplier, but eventually there would be no more manufacturers willing to produce at such a low cost for the sake of gaining a reputation. There was value in saying that you produced for Walmart, but there was nearly as much value in saying that you had been manufacturing goods for Walmart and then told the company to take a hike. Economies of scale did not have the same force in China as the principle did in other markets. One reason was that commodity prices were controlled at the national level. Raw materials sold in large-scale quantities at almost the same price that they sold in smaller amounts. Larger operations were more likely to be scrutinized by government officials, which meant higher compliance costs. And then there was the matter of manual labor, still coming in cheaper, especially when managed in an informal, local manner. These factors helped explain why so many sectors were still fragmented and why large manufacturers subcontracted work out to small shops, even when they had capacity to do the work themselves in their shiny new facilities. Johnson Carter enjoyed low prices until King Chemical took on new customers who could pay higher prices. These smaller customers would create volume of their own, and they set a benchmark that the manufacturer felt Johnson Carter also had to match. It had taken years to work out the kinks in the supplier relationship, and Johnson Carter was less inclined to switch suppliers and start all over again. The factory owners understood this, and it emboldened them to raise prices further. At the end of the day, Johnson Carter would rather pay a little more than risk trying a new supplier relationship. Commodity prices were on the rise, but what was changing even faster was the attitude of factory owners. American importers were feeling the pinch more than any other group, and this had everything to do with how manufacturers were no longer interested in giving their first market importers a major break. Chinese manufacturers wanted the price that United States consumers were paying to be more in line with what consumers were paying elsewhere around the globe. Taking manufacturing orders to China had once appeared a bargain, but that advantage was slipping as Chinese manufacturers saw fewer reasons to give American importers such significant discounts. Chinese manufacturers found that they did not need their first market importers as much. After a few years of working with these importers, the bulk of know-how had been transferred, and volume from second market importers was significant enough that the first market importer made up an increasingly smaller percentage of revenue. All of these things added to pricing pressure. American importers who came to China did business in a manner that was more straightforward. They bought a product for a dollar, expecting to sell it for two. Chinese suppliers, on the other hand, sold a product for a dollar when it cost them a dollar to make. They did this because they wanted to catch the customer's customer, or they were running a real estate play, or they were looking to build up important personal connections with government officials. Chinese manufacturers did not think in a linear fashion. They saw business as multidimensional. Importers were thinking checkers, while manufacturers were playing chess. American importers who did business in China scratched their heads and asked, "How do they do it?" That was what Bernie had asked me on his first trip to China, and the answer was made clear. The deal that King Chemical offered was not much different than a no-money-down special. There was naturally a catch, but importers figured that they would somehow come out ahead, and they even felt sorry for their suppliers when they were offered these too-good-to-be-true enticements. Importers streamed into China. They trained their suppliers and did not realize that it would end with their manufacturer in the driver's seat. Chinese suppliers practice a kind of economic jujitsu, which entailed using an importer's own greed against itself. It was straight out of Sun Tzu's The Art of War, and it only occurred to importers much later, if it occurred to them at all, that their suppliers knew from the very start where they planned to be at the endgame. When the United States pushed for greater levels of bilateral trade with China in the 1990s, it was under the assumption that China would become easier to work with as it rose to prosperity. If the importer-manufacturing relationship has shown anything, though, it is that the opposite is true. As Chinese manufacturers have grown bigger and wealthier, they have managed to find, and to exercise, more leverage in their relationships with foreign buyers. The manufacturer-importer relationship can be seen as an allegory for the future of relations between the United States and China, and one of the challenges going forward will be to learn how to engage China. Some leaders may feel that they have only the political past to use as a guide, but in fact, they have many microcosmic examples to take from business, and in those models can be found an appreciation for a variety of strategies and tactics. When it comes to free trade, taking a backward step is many orders of magnitude less desirable than not moving forward toward increased levels of openness. During the Clinton administration, when most favored nation status for China was debated in Congress, there was a chance for the United States to hold out for political and economic reform in China, but the opportunity was lost. Improved structural conditions made possible then might have more appropriately set the stage for stability going forward. Instead, American politicians and business leaders rushed headlong into greater levels of interdependency with China, a nation whose reliability is questionable. This decision to fling open wide the doors of trade with China before we were ready, before China was ready, before we understood what we were getting into, an action motivated by our own greed, this decision more than anything else was the one thing related to China that was truly poorly made.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of Poorly Made in China, an insider's account of the tactics behind China's production game. Written by Paul Midler. Narrated by Paul Midler. Executive Producer, Jennifer Basick. Producer, Mike Charzik. Production Coordinator, Kat Lambrix. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 2009 by Paul Midler. Production copyright 2009 by Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.